Welcome to the latest installment of the Paige Bacon Podcast, where we talk about everything and anything related to the written word. I'm John.
And I'm Ron.
And with us in the studio today is Curtis Fry, a prolific technical writer and corporate consultant with unquestionably generous catalog of publications under his belt, having produced a ridiculous number of guides for Microsoft products that nearly everyone on the planet is familiar with. He is a developer of webcasts on data management, technical training, and certification programs, and he can tell you everything you need to know to win online at poker. Known to those that are in the know as That Excel Guy, he is a seasoned corporate speaker on topics of software and technology and serves as the president of Technology and Society Incorporated. If that isn't enough, Kurt also dabbles in the mathematical dark arts, performing a boggling branch of stage magic known as mentalism, which with any luck, he'll give us a taste of at the end of the show. Curtis, thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Most listeners probably think of writers as authors of dime store novels or presidential biographies. So explain to us in layman's terms what a technical writer is.
Well, first, I wouldn't draw these days that much of a distinction between a dime store novelist and a presidential biographer.
Okay, fair enough.
Apparently, a recent Reagan biography involved a fair amount of fantasy and not just the kind that came out during press conferences. But I guess as a technical writer, what I do is I explain how to do things. So my overarching goal as a writer and as someone who produces online training courses for lynda.com is to have people go home on time. So what I do is I take software that they have to use as part of their day, whether it be Microsoft Excel, which is mostly what I specialize in, and teach them how to do things that they need to do as part of their job so that they can go see their kid's soccer game or maybe occasionally take a day off.
Now, are you writing different books to different levels of people, or are you tending to write sort of a universal thing for people?
I write books at different levels.
Okay.
Now, actually, these days, most of the books that I write are for Microsoft Press as part of the step-by-step series, and that is meant to be a training series where you can go in, start with no knowledge of Excel, but good knowledge of computers, or at least some knowledge of computers.
You know how to use a mouse.
You know how to use a mouse and a keyboard if you're lucky. And then you can work through the book, which contains exercises and downloadable exercise files. And at the end, you'll have a level of competence with Excel where you can go out and get a job. So those are mostly what I do, but I've written at the very basic beginner level, what Microsoft called the Plain and Simple series, which unfortunately has since been discontinued. And then also I wrote a book, Excel 2003, Programming Inside Out, which went into the deep, dark details of Visual Basic for Applications in Excel.
Wow, so that gets pretty detailed there.
It can.
So it seems to be considered a guru of such exponentially evolving software that you need to stay one step ahead of the market at all times and anticipate the consumer needs and develop useful guides before the applications themselves are obsolete. Do you have a method for keeping on top of the industry in order to ensure the ways that your work stays relevant long after it hits the shelves?
I read a lot. I spend about 2 hours a day on the internet reading various things. Now, that includes the geopolitical stuff that I read from Strategic Forecasts. It includes the New York Times, things like The Economist, which thank goodness only comes out once a week, and The Wall Street Journal, which comes out every day, but only usually has about 5 stories that I actually care about, so I can flip through that pretty well. I actually do have a paper subscription to The Wall Street Journal, so I think that makes me a throwback, at least on the West Coast.
Right. Now, are you also looking at technical stuff online, like Stack Exchange, finding out where people are having problems? And
I don't look on Stack Exchange that much. Mm. I tend to focus more on the needs of the general user. I find that Stack Exchange and GitHub projects tend to be for more specialized users and for folks who already bring a lot of background and knowledge to a problem, and they're just blocked on one certain thing. But when someone gives them, you say, well, you can use a sum product formula for that. And they're like, oh, okay, yes, you're absolutely right. That would fix the problem immediately. And I also take a lot of courses online. I go through Coursera, and I've taken something like 20 or 25 classes through them, some for a certificate, some for not. But I'm always learning stuff like Python programming, which I hope to expand into later. me.
Speaking of expanding.
Leave it in or edit it. I don't care.
Let's stand.
Okay. Well, I apologize. And then also, I'm taking MBA classes through the University of Illinois. They have a new online program called IMBA, which is short for Interactive MBA. And so far, I've taken managerial accounting, microeconomics, and I'm doing macroeconomics right now.
Wow.
So, yeah, I try to keep myself busy, but it's always about learning, and it's always about learning skills that I can pass on to folks. Because if it's important enough to be taught by a university, that means that they at least believe you need to know it.
Right.
Can I ask you, because I have several open source programs that I use, like Blender, and a bunch of these programs require that you install this Python thing, which I just do. But what is Python? Anyways.
Python is a programming language. And
So it's a language.
It's like
Ruby or C. Uh-huh.
Right. Yeah. It's a language, but you need to have the environment, the Python environment installed to work with it, or a Python environment. There are actually quite a number of them, and it depends on your preferred style of working, who you're friends with. Actually tends to be very important in the open source world because, you know, if your friend developed something or contributed to a project, then you're much more likely to use it. But there are a lot of good Python installs out there. As long as you're working with the base language, the specifics of what you do with, for example, interactive or, you know, some sort of procedural work, then it won't be a problem. It can translate with minor modifications most times.
Yeah, I have some great programs that I use that are open source. I just never knew what Python was.
Yeah, well, I encourage folks to use whatever program meets their needs the best. So if that, you know, if it's Google Docs, fine. I don't know why, but that's okay.
All right, shifting gears a bit. You worked in the defense industry in the DC area for a while. How did that work affect your development as a writer?
In a number of different ways. My undergraduate major was in political science. So I finally land a job in D.C. at a tech company, the MITRE Corporation, a defense contractor. And I start working with folks with electrical engineering degrees, aerospace engineering degrees, and computer programmers, like hardcore programmers. Mm. And I had to learn very quickly how to interact with them, how to support them as a technical writer. And then over the course of my 4 years with the company, I worked all the way up to a member of the technical staff. But eventually, we all agreed that a defense company in D.C. was not a good fit for me.
Right.
And I left by mutual acclaim. What I would do was I would do technical writing and sometimes be a subject matter expert for political stuff based on whatever data folks were looking at. One very interesting project that I worked on, which has been reported in conferences, was the natural language processing program that was used to do early versions of textual analysis that you see today in things such as sentiment analysis and semantic markup. So the semantic web idea that's been going around where you have a lot more metadata.
As a web developer and designer, yeah, I'm very familiar
very,
with
very familiar
doing
with that.
Semantic meaning and the way you mark up your pages.
Exactly. And it's, you know, how do you know the difference between coordinate, the noun, and coordinate,
right,
the verb? Now, that's more syntactic than semantic markup, but it's important to be able to understand between the two.
Just letting you know that everything you're saying is going right over my head.
That's where I was aiming.
You got it.
And there's the core of technical writing. Now,
what I try to do is if I get feedback saying, you know what, that's too complicated for me, then I say, okay, let's go to a more basic level. Because if I don't give you the scaffolding that you need to understand everything that I'm saying, if it's really important, then I need to figure out a way to get you there.
Right.
And that is my responsibility as a writer and a trainer. So I get a lot of feedback saying, well, the first half of this course is way too easy for me. Yeah.
Exactly.
Exactly. But right. there's somebody in Bloomington, Indiana for whom it's not.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Tell me if this is not an accurate description, but as far as the technical writers I work with in software, they're sort of the Rosetta Stone of the staff in that they talk to the engineers about the technical nitty-gritty of what's going on, but then they also have to write it so that our customers understand what's being described.
No, that's exactly right. And pardon me again. One of the things that I do is one of the things that I've learned over the years is how to talk and be an interface between different elements of the community. And when I do my performances, whether as an improviser or as a mentalist or a corporate speaker, I need to learn how to interact well with the audience and approach them on their terms.
So when a person writes a novel, they can basically publish whatever they want because it's fiction. But with a technical document, such as the books you write, is there a stringent quality control process for vetting user guides?
Yes. And frankly, if I didn't have my editors, I would have made myself look stupid in print more times than I could count. So the process that most places work is that you, the author, submit your first draft, and then it goes to a technical edit. It comes back to you as, you know, with the edits in, saying you messed this up, these steps are out of order, I don't have enough information to do this yet, that kind of thing. So then I make those fixes, and then it goes to a copy editor. You never want to do your copy edit before your technical edit, because the technical edit will always change things. And then also you need to do your review of the copy edit to make sure that changes to how style didn't mess anything up from a technical standpoint.
Right.
So it's this ongoing iterative process where you're trying to trying to get the best product possible. And then you have proofreading, and then you have a final read, and there are just so many different checks that are built in. And yet, in every 500-page book, at least a dozen errors always get through.
I'm sure. Yep. Now, as you're doing that, as you're getting closer and closer to publish, you have to probably be much more exacting about how accurate it is, yet you've already read it hundreds of times. How hard does that get to be that sort of detail-oriented about it?
It's impossible.
Yeah, I mean, we edit books all the time, and the author is probably the worst person to edit their own work. That's what you always have to
because you read. I know, just writing just short things that you hear the words you meant to write.
Yeah,
and you don't see what
you
your
are
own
blind
mistakes
to
are.
All of your words on the page. You know, it takes someone else behind you to make it right.
Right, and you need to pay those people. They need to be good at what they do. They need to be motivated.
Absolutely.
For what they do. And I have found that money is an outstanding motivator.
Usually is. And then also, if they don't do a good job, then you don't have to motivate them the next time.
That's true. But you hope you choose well, because if you didn't choose the right person, that's at least in part on you.
Yeah. Describe your hobby of mentalism.
Well, it's not a hobby. I do get paid for it.
You got to pay them.
There you go.
Exposure don't pay the rent.
How do you feel that those things feed each other, being a technical writer and doing the mentalism?
Mentalism is about communication, and I don't have any superpowers. I haven't invented a new branch of physics. But what I have done is develop a series of demonstrations that illustrate the power of skill and of the ability to make a mind-to-mind connection sometimes. Mm. Nothing I do is 100%. And it can be really frustrating at times when I go up on stage and something doesn't work exactly the way I want it to, or perhaps not at all. And what happens then is that I just have to take what's known in theater as the failure bell. Mm-hmm. Just like, I failed. Thank you. And so many times that happens when you're working on something early in your career, and the idea is that you want to build it up over time. And the way to get back to your question, the way that it connects to technical writing is that in technical writing, I'm trying to explain one technical thing that is understood by the developers, usually, with the audience who needs to learn how to use whatever software or product was developed. So with mentalism, what I do is I bring people into a theatrical world that allows them to experience the wonder of an ability that they didn't have before. Is this something they'll be able to do later without my guidance? Probably not. If they can, I'd really like to know how, because they're probably doing something different than I did.
Right.
But there are so many different ways that you can create connections. And when you have a skill that someone else doesn't have, it looks like a miracle to them.
Right, right. I've seen people accuse you of being a witch.
They're wrong.
Yeah.
The proper term is warlock. Yeah, the sure, proper yeah, term is, yeah. is, in fact, warlock.
Well, there were screams to burn you. So
I get that a lot, not only in that context.
Sure.
So you know, it's all about communication. It's all about a willingness to share and a willingness to be open. And, you know, in the technical world, everybody talks about being willing to fail fast. Well, I've got 11 opportunities to fail in 60 minutes when I'm in front of a crowd. Maybe. And if that's not failing fast, I don't know what is.
Well, to give you an opportunity to fail, could you maybe give us a little demonstration?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
Now, Ron, I don't think you've seen me work before.
I did. Actually, I saw you at the last Hey Dell.
Oh, at the Jack London Lounge.
Right. And I was one of the guys calling him a witch. So, yeah, I would really like to see a demonstration of
sure.
this.
Sure. Okay. Well, I'll have you participate directly.
Okay.
So I have a glass with this is a Waterford crystal from the sale rack. So a group of four was $29 instead of $75. So yes. I like Waterford, but I'm really cheap.
Okay. So
I'm gonna hand that over to you, trying not to bump the microphone as I go.
Okay, so now I have this glass in my hand. It's got this little black satin kind of bag in it.
That would be velour. And it was the cheapest velour I could find. So yeah. Okay. You can buy those for, you know, 10 for $5 or something like that. So please go ahead and open the bag.
So
and
Kurt also has apparently a goodwill skill about him too.
Okay. So I'm opening up the velour pouch.
Yep. And there should be, if I did this right, five objects in there. So please describe what you find.
The first thing I'm pulling out is a brass lock.
Okay. It's a padlock.
Padlock.
Opened by a single key in the bottom.
Okay. And then I'm pulling out the next object. Is a key.
Okay. You can go ahead and place that in the glass for the moment.
Okay. Put the key in the glass.
Yep.
But not the lock.
Correct.
Okay. And then I'm pulling out another key.
Yep. And there should be two more keys in there.
Okay. And here we go. Two more keys.
Excellent. Okay. So, and the bag is empty as far as you can tell?
Yep. Looks empty.
Thank goodness. Okay. You can set the bag aside. We won't use it for the next few minutes.
Okay.
Now, please dump the four keys into your hand. And we're going to see which of the four opens the lock. If the key does not open the lock, then please drop it in the glass.
I've got now the four keys are in my left hand. I'm going to use my other hand to try to open this lock. I put the first one in. Does not open it.
No good. So go ahead and drop it in the glass.
Okay, that goes back in the glass.
Yep. And
next key does not open it.
Nope.
Dropping it in the glass. Third key, no go.
Okay.
Going to put that in the glass. And I'm guessing the fourth key. Nothing.
No, that's because it's this one that I kept in my pocket.
Okay, so
I don't like doing that joke, but I have to. It's a union work rule.
All right. So
I'm going to pass what should be the working key over to you.
Okay.
So Kurt, have you made that mistake before? Yes. Yes, I have.
Okay, so I have what's supposed to be the working key. I'm putting it in the lock. And it indeed opens the padlock.
Okay, right. So please drop the working key into the glass.
Okay.
You can close the hasp on the lock. Both of those things need to happen. The order isn't really important.
Now all five keys are in the glass, and I've got the brass lock locked.
All right, please set the lock aside for a moment. We're going to be working with the keys.
Okay.
So pick up the glass and give it a good shake close to the microphone.
Yahtzee.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And go ahead and dump the keys out onto the table in front of you. Perfect. Now, do you have any locksmith training, or have you taken a lockpicking class?
No.
Okay, good. Because if you memorize the cut pattern, this would be really, really short demonstration.
I lose a lot of keys, though. I do.
Okay. Those are just regular keys. I have them cut for 35 cents each because I know a guy.
Okay, so we got the keys kind of spread out on the table. I just dumped them out of the glass.
Excellent. And so, Ron, are you a positive thinker or a negative thinker?
Positive.
Okay. Yeah. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because I'd say the same line next anyway.
I'm positive. I don't know.
Oh, good. Nope. Honesty is extremely important. So go ahead and look down at those five keys.
Okay.
And think, I'm positive this key does not open the lock.
I am positive this key does not open the lock.
Please.
I have my finger on one.
Okay. Please pick up that key and put it in the glass.
Okay.
Great. So we have four keys left.
Four keys.
Okay, so let's change our thinking. Let's go back to the really positive instead of the sort of circumlocution that I used before.
Here we go.
So look down at those four keys and pick two that you think might open the lock. So we're not looking for a definite choice. We're just trying to narrow it down.
Okay, I'm thinking this one will open it.
Yep.
And this one will open the lock.
So those are your two candidates.
Right. I've got two in my hand.
Yep. Please eliminate the other two.
What do you mean? Put them in the glass?
Put them in the glass.
Okay, so I'm putting the leftover two back in the glass.
Okay, so you have two keys left.
Right.
Hold them up in front of you.
Got two
keys. And we're going with your intuition here. Because what we've done is, rather than just have you select a key with a 1 out of 5 chance, I'm giving you a chance to do what they call running between the raindrops. You had to avoid the correct key the first time. You had to avoid the correct key twice on this last choice. So it's kind of like Deal or No Deal, but the model isn't quite as attractive.
Okay.
So look at those two keys.
Okay.
And because you're a positive thinker, in your mind, just say, I'm positive it's this one.
Oh, it's the left one, the one in my left hand.
It's the one in your left hand.
Absolutely.
Drop the other one in the glass.
There you go.
Pick up the lock, and let's see how you did. Now, before you do, do you feel like I've been influencing your choices at all?
No.
Have you ever tried this sort of demonstration before?
Because my mind has been completely empty, and I'm just doing whatever you do. I haven't really thought of it.
That makes it a lot easier, actually. So because you've never done this before,
right?
If it doesn't work, who gets the blame?
You.
Correct. If it does work, whose intuition made it work?
Mine, of course.
So then you get all the credit.
For being a warlock.
So let's see how it goes.
Okay.
No way!
And the lock
opened. Open the lock.
So congratulations. You have shown good intuition, and I trust you to make many more good choices in the future.
Fantastic.
That is crazy.
Yeah, I have goosebumps right now. So just, I know that you can't give away how you do this, but a little bit of insight on, is it math? Is it deduction of some kind that you use?
I don't know. You're the one who picked the key.
I knew you were going to say that.
It is a useful demonstration of how you can determine the right thing, even though you don't always know how.
Well, if anybody wants to see this live somewhere, Kurt, do you have any upcoming shows where people can come see you?
I am doing Magic of the Mind on June 3rd. At Comedy Sports in the after hours. So you can come to the regular Comedy Sports show and then come see me. And then most of my other stuff is private shows.
Okay.
So, you know, but that'll be my next one. I am going to try to start working a lot more in the public, though.
All right. Go see that after hour show. You will not be disappointed. His show is filled with stuff where you go, what? No way.
Yeah, definitely the live show is much more crazy than what you've just heard here.
I wanted to put together a demonstration that would work well through an audio medium.
Yeah.
It's a lot better when I can work with folks and make eye contact with them.
Yeah,
and actually
visually.
And ask them about themselves, because that provides so much more interesting material.
Yeah. So I want to mention that Kurt has several websites out there. He has curtisfrye.com, F-R-Y-E. There's thatexcelguy.com. And TechSoch, TechSoch.com.
That's Technology and Society Book Reviews. I've been doing book reviews since 1998. I've published something like 130 or 135 book reviews on there. Well, I wanted to write that kind of book, you know, a book that looks at the intersection of technology and society. And in 1998, I didn't have enough money to buy books. So I started a website and publishers sent them to me.
Excellent. And all these links will also be on the pagebacon.com website.
Fantastic. All right. Thanks, Kurt.
Yep. Great. Thanks a lot for having me.
Bye.